I want to begin by again introducing ourselves. I'm Jim Addington. This is my wife, Nadine. We're from St. Paul, Minnesota. And we'll take just a few minutes to briefly review the ground we covered last night and where we intend to go the next four sessions. And then we'll launch into this morning's session on environmental racism. In terms of our first series, Racism as a Socio-Spirit Force, our intent is to deal with these five topics. First, we touched on last night the dynamics of racism. This morning, we'll take a look at environmental racism as an illustration of what we call institutionalized racism last night. And then finally, our third session, we'll take a look at kind of the historical scope. What are the historical roots of racism in America, in Minnesota? Or as they say in Minnesota, roots. I don't know what you say in Washington or Minnesota. And then finally, we want to look at the myth of racial identity and how it became turned into the myth of racial superiority. And the poetic title for that session is Planks Over the Abyss. And then finally, we want to work a bit on our role as those who follow Jesus and take a look at social repentance and ask what might be the unique role of the church in relation to this particular social challenge that confronts our nation and many nations these days as we move to the end of this millennium. Now, just a quick brushstroke in terms of where we went last night. We suggested to you that racism is a complex, ambiguous, hard to pin down social reality that is both a sociological reality and a spiritual force. And it's a spiritual force because it's a mode of consciousness that's based on a mythological understanding of life. And we talked about racism as an institutional, as a social reality being made up at least of prejudice and the dynamic of prejudice and discrimination, and the third term being power. And then we also talked about it basically as a reflecting mythology that is dramatized in social rituals or liturgies, and that there are symbols, icons, and images that empower the mythology of racial superiority in the social rituals. And we'll have a chance to dip more into those, particularly in the fourth session. Then suggested to you also last night that there are certain temptations that it's important to be aware of and to decide to step around these days when you're dealing with racism, and especially when you're dealing with European Americans. One of those that's important to take into account is guilt. That guilt tripping and head beating is a temptation that we need to avoid, and for a couple of reasons. One is that when you begin to work on people's guilt, there tends to be two responses. One is they become hardened in their sin, so to speak. That is, hardness of heart as a defense mechanism takes over, and they simply decide to ignore what goes on. Or the other side of that is that it's disempowering. That you work on somebody's guilt and it tends to be disempowering. And our intent and our hope really is the other side of the coin. That is, for those of us who grasp ourselves as men and women of conscience and as part of the Church of Jesus Christ, well, it's time to empower our activity. And social repentance depends upon empowered men and women. And so, therefore, it's important to avoid the temptation of guilt-tripping and head-beating in dealing with racism. And mind you, particularly when you're talking about ourselves, well, there's more than enough to go around, and speaking of guilt, that is. And we want to talk a little later on in one of our sessions about the importance of us deciding to own our heritage, to own who we are in the history of this nation and in the history of the Americas as a part of the dynamic of empowerment. And last night it became clear to us, I think, as we talked, that part of racism is simply taking for granted white privilege. And in that sense, racism is an ongoing force in society. It doesn't even really depend upon our being self-consciously prejudiced. Many of us in the room may experience ourselves as not being racially prejudiced. And yet, because we've come to depend on and unreflectively take for granted white privilege, we participate in the ongoing dynamic of racism in this society. And therefore, in a manner of speaking, it is appropriate to speak of ourselves as racists, even though we may experience ourselves in the first instance as not being prejudiced. So that's kind of a quick and dirty review of where we went last night, and there's much more to be said about that. I'm sure that you would have much more to say about it. And we would very much like to encourage you to share with us what else you have to say that you don't find a way to say in the confines of these walls as we work together in racism. Now today, to turn a little bit different direction and take a look at environmental racism as an illustration of what we call institutionalized racism.
We're sitting in the center of a donut surrounded by a hazardous waste incinerator that gives off PCBs, seven landfills that are constantly growing. They look like mountains, Hazel Johnson was saying. There are chemical plants, a paint factory, two steel mills which give off odors and lagoons filled with all kinds of contaminants that emit 30,000 tons of poison into the air each year. And there's a water reclamation district where they dry sludge out in the open. The smell is horrible, like bodies decomposing. Mrs. Johnson was describing At Gill Gardens, a housing project in which 10,000 people, nearly all African Americans, reside on the southeast side of Chicago, surrounded on every side by sources of pollution. The result? Environmental disease and death. We have lots of cancer, respiratory problems, birth deformities. Just the other day, there were 3 cancer deaths, then more. We've been having babies born with brain tumors. One baby was born with her brain protruding from her head. She's now 2, blind, and she can't walk. My daughter was 5 months pregnant. She took ultrasound and the doctors found the baby had no behind and no head. The baby had to be aborted. Ms. Johnson has no doubt that the terrible health problems we have in our community are related to the pollution, the product of trying to live amid one of the most concentrated areas of environmental contamination in the United States. And she is clear about why her area gets dumped on, because it is largely inhabited by African Americans and Hispanics. In Chicago, everything is mostly dumped out in this area where we are. They figure that we are not going to come out and protest and disagree. How many stories have you heard like that? Quite a few.
I'm from Chicago area, not from Chicago area, but south of Chicago, and I know what that's like. Mm-hmm.
Anybody else have any other areas?
I've seen it.
Yeah. That last statement strikes me that they figure that we're not going to say anything, and we're not going to protest. Why do they figure that? What do you think?
Figure
they're weak and they're powerless. And this morning, we want to briefly get into a workshop with the aid of my colleague here who's going to write for us. We're going to look at environmental racism from a different perspective, but also see the dynamics of what goes on when you're dealing with a situation where you find people who experience themselves as powerless. So the first part of this workshop, we're going to brainstorm ideas in places, I'm going to take this chalk and run there in columns, on environmental issues, first of all. And that's from wherever you've come from, just say whatever that environmental issue is for your community, your neighborhood, rural, urban, whatever that is. So we're going to start with the environmental issues first. Anyone?
Nuclear waste.
Nuclear waste?
Polluted water.
Polluted water.
Not so fast there.
Someone take it.
A garbage dump and not the recycling in our area is quite a bit.
A garbage dump.
Garbage dump and not recycling.
And not recycling. Okay. Others.
Chemical waste.
Chemical waste.
Pesticide use.
Okay.
Air pollution.
Wait a minute, I'm getting behind. Okay.
You got. Was there one before air pollution?
Yes, there was. There's pesticide use.
Pesticide. Okay.
Continued.
Deforestation.
Oh yes.
Continued use by manufacturers of materials that are not recycled.
Okay. Okay, now we gotta stop. Stop that brainstorm. What groups deal with some of these from your areas? I hope you have enough room for that.
We could even get a few more.
You mean people who are combating those, or
yes,
people who actually contribute to it?
The groups that are trying to deal with those.
There are recycling groups set up in most cities, I know, but they usually have to be formed by people like.
So you have some kind of recycling
organization,
okay.
But they're not usually implemented by the city themselves unless there's a lot of
EPA
pressure.
Okay. Hold on that for it, but at least you got a recycling group. Yeah. Others.
Greenpeace.
Sierra Club. Okay.
Someone said the EPA.
Yep,
that's right, EPA. Any others?
Nuclear Regulatory Agency.
NRA.
Positions for social responsibility.
Positions
for social responsibility.
For social responsibility.
Okay. I'll just say PSR.
Yeah. If we can remember those names. Other groups.
I think there's an engineering group similar to also.
Okay. Yes. Engineers for Social Responsibility. I'll say ESR.
Any others?
Concerned citizens.
Okay. I'll step on this side. We're coming over on this side. Under this category, I want us to quickly brainstorm. Are you going to write another group up here?
No.
Okay. Social justice group.
Social
justice issues in your area. Quickly, just call us any social justice, social
housing.
Justice issues.
I heard you.
Housing.
Healthcare.
Employment opportunities.
Childcare.
Education.
I heard the education over here. And childcare was another. Somebody say childcare.
Distribution of wealth.
Food.
What about food?
Hunger. Poverty.
The whole homeless is housing, but is separate.
Gang violence.
Drug trafficking.
What was that?
Drugs.
But alcohol too at the same time.
Okay, what groups in the area are trying to deal with some of these?
Church.
Just church.
Mad.
Two D's.
Oh. Yes.
Do you mean groups other than the government?
I'm sorry?
Do you mean groups?
Yes.
Other than the government?
Yes.
Because the government takes care of some of it. Or should try.
No, this is definitely groups other than the government. Support groups? Who said support?
I.
Okay.
Any particular support groups?
Specifics.
Support groups for abuse,
like AA.
Women's shelter.
AA, women's shelter.
Habitat.
United Way.
United Way?
YMCA.
What's that?
The YMCA.
YMCA. YMNYW.
ARC.
We have ARC.
Did you say ARC?
ARC.
ARC.
ARC. And somebody said we have what?
We have PATH, what they call PATH. It has to do with children calling in or people, abused people calling in for help.
PATH?
PATH, yeah.
Okay. Also, the Nation of Islam is especially beginning to gear down on gang violence.
Yeah, you get a chance to put one out too.
There's a lot of different health organizations.
Health organizations?
National Health, these groups.
What about Alcoholics Anonymous?
AA.
AA.
Okay, ship, hold, ship hold.
Ship hold?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's not really that anymore, but it's doing that.
Yeah, I'm out of room.
I noticed that, I noticed that. Now, I want this to first look at.
Okay, yeah, first one.
And on the issues for both the environmental and the social justice, any similarities that you see with these two issues? And just talk about it a little bit. What are the similarities?
Water, nuclear waste, and all that would have to do with health care and all that.
Okay.
Hmm. Yeah. Interesting.
And you
would draw a, okay. That would, you know, contribute to the sicknesses and what have you. All this.
Water and health care?
Yeah, water and health care definitely has something similar.
Air pollution
and
pesticides
relates to health care. Okay.
Education covers a whole bunch of them. Because,
we have education up here?
Social justice.
Okay. And related to?
Well, to recycling.
Yes.
A number of these things would better be done if the people were better educated in how to deal with them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, more generally, if you're suffering, if you're someone lacking in one of these, housing, food, education, you don't have. You can't get beyond that. That's all you can deal with. You can't fight these things.
Mm-hmm.
So you're a victim more so, and you can't reach out and have the.
So you're saying your overall well-being, right. Based on these basic right. needs, if that's what you're dealing with, you're not going to worry about this stuff over here.
Right. You certainly can't
and
be
you can't.
Empowered to okay. fight against it. You're going to be more victimized. It's sort of like a double whammy.
Okay. So that's like hunger and health and education, okay.
Employment opportunities are pointed to a number of things on the far side is why we need to do what is getting for we are.
So employment.
We're deforestation, but we need the jobs. We're nuclear waste, but we need that for peak power.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's.
Something like that, okay. Other reflections of similarities.
I guess the flip side of that, too, is that it's very unlikely that one of the Fortune 500 companies is going to build their corporate headquarters in a place that has all these environmental issues, so it really doesn't affect the other side of the fund opportunities. So
it's really a broader one than just these two. It relates to several of these.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Distribution of wealth.
Distribution of wealth.
Is here.
And
is there
any particular location of where you're going to do these, you know, where you're going to dump your nuclear waste or create your nuclear waste, where you're going to put your garbage dump?
Yep. Yes, indeed.
Hmm.
Just as two, there's several others.
All right.
I believe in using non-recyclable materials, you're looking at employment and supposedly keeping jobs. And someone told me yesterday, the day before, about being able to buy recycled toilet paper in the store, and it's like twice as expensive as the stuff that's just fresh.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
It already uses toilet paper.
I don't know.
Other reflections on similarities.
What about pesticide use and hunger?
Yes. Oh.
Interesting.
What do you see as the similarity between that?
Well, we use too much pesticide, you know, and that's, of course, I don't know whether it can bring on hunger or not, but it's not good.
Well, hunger is certainly one of the rationales for using pesticides. Crop production.
But that would be more with distribution as well.
But really, it's the healthcare, too.
Well, it depends on where you are.
Yeah.
Because in the country that I live in, they use pesticides on cotton, and they grow cotton instead of crops.
Yeah.
So the hunger is related to what they produce.
Let's reflect on some of the groups now. What's some of the similarities between the groups here? What are you trying to do?
Seems more people are concerned with social justice in that environment.
You mean you have a lot more on the social justice working part?
The groups are smaller. Takes a fewer number of people, you know, and the groups are pretty much local organizations or groups, and the other ones are more powerful and bigger.
Okay. Any other observations?
Well, our churches are with Habitat, very much involved with Habitat, and we do a number of times have helped create homes for people that were not able to afford them, and they are now living in nice homes that our church has been and our community has built for these people, helped reach these people that were homeless before.
Other reflections?
Not too much crossover in membership in these two groups. I suspect, at least my experience is, but not too much crossover.
Some of that really are separate.
And some of that's economics. If you get Greenpeace or National Wildlife Federation, if you don't have $25, you know, a lot of this is membership kind of stuff that you think about. And these, we do in our own communities. Yeah. We don't have to pay to be a part of it. But a lot of these other things, you have to have some bucks to be a part of.
That's an interesting observation.
I wonder if we should have the churches under both sets of groups. Or in dealing with environmental issues as well as social justice issues. Depends upon the church, but some churches have been fairly active in both areas.
Mm. That's interesting too, because that might then be a point of crossover.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Other observations?
Well, mainly environmental issues and such have to do with production and material, social justice is people.
Okay. Did everybody hear that information? Would you repeat that for us?
Well, we're talking about production, materialism on the left side and people on the right side.
Mm-hmm. All right.
You're much more likely to find people of color on the right side as opposed to on the left side.
Your right side, meaning social justice?
Yep.
And what, over here?
You're much more likely to find people of color on this.
Social justice?
Yes.
How many people of color are members of Greenpeace or Sierra Club? Mm-hmm. Interesting observation.
Well, that brings me to the next step in our brainstorm to look at what's underlying both what we brainstorm on
On the right side, you have survival issues. On the left side, it's...
Okay, survival issues. And what's this?
On the right side is survival issues.
Right side is survival.
And left side is what?
I don't know what you call it.
Probably
deferred survival.
Deferred survival. Social justice seems to be more immediate, and then environmental seems to be
a little bit more abstract.
More abstract. Okay.
But it depends where you stand, doesn't it?
Yes.
If you're one of these groups, you know, you would say it was immediate survival.
Okay. Now, to move on to my question about the underlying root cause of both environmental issues and social justice issues. What would you say are the underlying issues?
What's common? Power and greed.
Greed. Power. Greed.
Materialism.
Materialism.
Mm-hmm.
Money.
Privilege and superiority.
Privileges, superiority. I didn't hear the last.
Capitalism.
Now, I want to honor what you're saying, but I'm wondering if you might.
What do you mean by capitalism?
Push that just a bit in any of these.
Yeah, I would go with power, maybe. Capitalism. Or money.
If you look at environmentalism, of course, in the countries that live under communism, a very different economic system, you would do not have a positive record. So.
That's right. That's true.
Money is the way you distribute it, more than just money. Money is not the problem. It's how it's distributed. Who has it?
Who has it and who doesn't?
Frustration.
Frustration is a root cause. Some other comments here?
I just said mostly it's have and have nots.
Mostly we're have and have nots.
The ones that have and the ones that have not.
Yeah. Lack of compassion.
Okay. Others?
Are there any other comments on capitalism or any of these broader kind of abstract categories that would might help us tie it down as to what the root is?
Well, capitalism is the everything. I mean, as far as environmental issues, the goal is to make most money. So it's not profitable for a company to be environmental. It's not profitable to use recycled goods because they're more expensive, and that the profit motive comes from capitalism. And then,
you can talk about some of our slogans that were related to that. If it's not profitable, then we can't obviously sell the product or whatever. Okay. Any other insights, comments about the common roots of this?
Ignorance would be one of them.
Ignorance? Say some more.
Well, a lot of people who, so many, we're kind of brainwashed. I mean, we don't see the connection between what we consume how it affects somebody else. We see no connection between what we eat necessarily and how it affects, you know, the larger population or what we wear or, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm.
Lack of awareness for the common good.
Okay, it's just lack of awareness for the common good.
And opportunity. Lack of opportunity.
Lack of opportunity. Now, how would you talk about the population? Who's most affected by most of our common groups in this brainstorm that we've listed here? Who's generally affected?
People without money.
The poor.
Minorities.
A lot of minorities.
Less educated.
The less educated. Because we're coming back to who's really in these groups, too.
Elderly. Who isn't?
Sorry?
The elderly.
Handicapped.
Somebody said children? Okay.
Yes.
Don't you think we could almost say the majority?
The majority
of the population of the country could start to be covered by those categories. I mean, that's maybe the debate we have is are more or less affected by this than not affected. Mm. Is that what's different?
Mm-hmm.
Today?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We recognize that we're affected by this, or we just were turning a blind eye to it, not paying attention to what's happening to us, whether we know it or not.
Okay, all right. We're finding ourselves showing up here. but we're not quite sure what we're going to do about it, except that we're forming groups to try to do that. All right. Now, our topic, we said, had to do with environmental racism. How do you see, from what we've done last night and up to now, environmental racism or racism playing into this dynamic, these issues, and what we've got out here, both social justice and environmental?
People of privilege.
Okay, we're still dealing with people of privilege. Others. Comment. Somebody mentioned the have and have nots up here.
Yeah, those with power are certainly going to be less affected by nuclear waste, polluted water, all the problems.
Okay.
You just can buy your way out of it.
Oh, okay. All right, buying your way out of it because you have money and you even have representatives. All right. Others?
I think it's less based on, like last night we were talking about white privilege, mm-hmm. but when you look at the people that are affected, elderly or black, white, and every color in between, and handicapped people, again, it's not based on color, mm-hmm. and yet you are still prejudiced and have to use that word racist against them mm-hmm. for these issues, and yet they are the majority of the population.
We're beginning to see our systems working itself out here too. Okay. Any other observation now?
Makes a difference whether we're talking about the people who are creating problems, people who are affected by the problem. So that, for example, we're talking about air pollution.
Mm-hmm.
I would guess that those of us who create air pollution, like by driving our cars, or consuming things that are produced by factories that create air pollution, don't have an explicitly racist agenda when we get in our car. You know, I don't think, gee, I think I'll do this thing. But that it's the people who have access to the resources that create the air pollution tend to be more likely to be people who have privilege partly on the basis of their race. And the people who get the worst effect of the air pollution may very likely be people of color. So that the racism that shows up in environmental issues is pretty submerged unless, you know, like for us, we don't see the connection. If we don't see the connection between driving our car and air pollution, then there's this more seemingly more distant connection that's even harder to see. Now that we don't have so much lead-free gas, we don't have so much lead in our gas, and so we don't. That's what's an example that used to get used a lot about kids in the city breathing the fumes of cars that had lead in the gas. So that was a little better than it was, but that would be a good example of how that works.
The only connection they'll find out is once somebody does the study about how many children are affected by the lead that they breathe, and the lead and the pain, et cetera, et cetera. And you begin to say, go ahead.
I guess one other thing about too is that this is a positive feedback, not in a good sense, but it results in a downward spiral of more difficulties. The kind of thing we're dealing with here. So it makes it much more difficult because it's a downward spiral in the sense that it comes out of our awareness in many ways, because we psychologically or physically distance ourselves from the issues. It also is a downward spiral in that because people who are already economically disadvantaged or oppressed end up having more physical problems, and it's part of that job. And it's self-perpetuating. It goes beyond the action of individuals. It's
clearly a linkage, isn't it? Right.
Also, this stuff doesn't come to public attention until it does happen to the white people. What happens to the elderly, what happens to the poor, all of this stuff that goes on, when it's happening to people of color, it never reaches the the medium until it affects enough people who are white and privileged, no matter what it is.
Yes, we have media coverage in certain instances when it hits the suburbs type of thing. And it's really going to become an issue now. We've got to start dealing with it.
Well, here in the Northwest, the spotted owl. Now, the spotted owl was very popular, but it took a whole group of people over here that were employed, white, middle class, and threw them into this area. They don't have housing, healthcare, schools are closing, you know, right down the line, because the spotted owl is protected, and 50,000 people are out of work.
Yeah, you know, picking up on the business of lead and gasoline is another illustration. That several years ago now, we stopped putting lead in gasoline that was intended for automobile use. And so now we've forgotten the problem because we've taken care of it. Except that we've forgotten that most of the people who breathe and ingest the years of exhaust fumes from leaded gasoline live in the inner city. And most of them are people of color. And the thing is that lead in soil doesn't leach away. It goes down about an inch, inch and a half, and that's it. And it's, in terms of what's happening in inner cities now, lead poisoning is the most serious health issue for inner city children. And it's of terrible, terrible cost to us. But we're unaware of it. And it's primarily because these are children of color. We've taken care of the problem because we no longer put lead in gasoline.
Well, we're on a couple of this.
I was just going to say, there are hidden things that we're unaware of, too, because if those children behave badly in school, it's because of their background or because they only have a single parent, and it maybe it's because of some hidden problem that we've already taken care of.
Yes.
And then the school is at fault because they can't handle the kid.
And the family's at fault because it doesn't have good moral values in bringing up that child. Yeah.
Like brain damage as a consequence of
lead poisoning. Exactly, that's what I mean. Yeah. Which
leads to shortened attention spans and so on.
Yeah. Child's not going to be worrying too much about learning if you're hungry.
Exactly.
Just a given. Well, we want to move to the third portion of this and look at the ways that this is played out some more. We have some articles to share.
Yeah. We don't have enough of these to pass around for everybody, so if I could ask you to share every other one, and even that is not going to be enough. And so I've written the contents of that sheet, and we'll go over it together. Not yet. I want to pick up on the brainstorming that you've done and really some of the very insightful comments that you've shared with us about the connections between environmental issues and social justice, racial justice issues. What I'm sharing with you are really the highlights, six of the highlights from a study that the United Church of Christ did that was published in 1987. The study was headed up by Ben Chavis of the United Church of Christ, the director of the Commission for Racial Justice. And this particular summation is reprinted from The Crisis, which is the publication of the NAACP from the April 1991 issue. And that's also the magazine that Nadine read from. We'll put it up on the table so you can see it later, but this is a very good little magazine with some surprisingly solidly researched and insightful articles in it. Very, very good. And we pulled the stuff in environmental racism out of many resources, but found this especially helpful. I'm wondering if you might spend a few minutes and take a look at some of these. And let's start with number one, and somebody who has the sheet, read for us, if you would, number one, finding number one, rather loudly so all of us can hear you. Anybody?
Race proved to be the most influential among variables tested in association with the location of commercial hazardous waste facilities. This represented a consistent national pattern.
In your local situation, can you think of any illustrations that would document this? In your own town or cities you're familiar with, where race would seem to be the most influential variable in determining where such were located. Yes?
The Mexicans that live in the little shacks and the, where they work in the fields and the orchards,
uh-huh,
where they live in Yakima.
Uh-huh.
No running water.
Okay. All right. Yes, any other reflections on this or illustrations you know of that would sort of document this finding? Does this surprise you? No, it doesn't surprise me. Yes?
We had quite a large percentage of Native Americans in our little town.
Uh-huh.
I would say the reason, though, is mainly the alcoholism. It's a health problem.
Yes.
Yeah, but it determines a lot of, it has to do with a lot of your...
Yes, it does. And really interesting that when you look at the whole picture of what's going on with people, there are all kinds of things going on. And often, the trail that you look for, that's the clues to institutionalized racism, are statistics that show you the incidence of certain kinds of problems, like alcoholism and like infant mortality rate. This is an aside, this is unrelated, but Minnesota has a reputation for being child and education oriented, and in our infant mortality rate among European American children, we are third best in the nation. Third best. I don't even remember who's better than we are. I think one of New England states and maybe Alaska or somebody. But when you look at African American children in Minnesota, we are number 27 on the list in our infant mortality rate. Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, all do better than we do at guarding black infants at that most fragile time of the first year of life. Now, that's not an indication of institutional racism. And that's what we mean, I think, by institutional racism. And the statistics that sort of lay out the trail for you, you know, give you the indices of institutional racism. And it would include things like rates of alcoholism in certain populations and so on.
But to pick up on what she's saying about the Native Americans, last night we were discussing the issue of how the media determines, you know, who's in the population and the public eye. Mm-hmm. We don't get a lot of media coverage for Native Americans at all. We don't get any. So it's almost like they determine who exists and who doesn't. So it's like the Native Americans don't exist. So in the state of Minnesota, we're having the issue of chemical waste being dumped in Prairie Island.
Mm-hmm. But here in the Northwest, when they're talking about environmental waste, like throwing garbage away from going hiking and things, they have a poignant commercial where a lone Indian on a horse is crying for the environment.
We've seen that too in mm-hmm. Minnesota. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I was just thinking about nuclear waste here in Washington, the Hanford site, of course. It seems to me that they picked the most deserted site they could initially. And it's, you know, the people that have come to work there have probably been basically white. Uh-huh. And those that are left to be affected by the waste, I think, are basically white.
So in that instance, it would seem not to be related to environmental racism. Uh-huh. Let's go on through the rest of these and then reflect back on some other illustrations you have and things that even seem to contradict, perhaps, some of these highlights. Someone read number two.
Communities with the greatest number of commercial hazardous waste facilities had the highest composition of ethnic residents.
Okay. And of course, by ethnic residents, most of them would be people of color, but that would also include newly arrived immigrants from Russia and other places, but primarily be people of color. Someone read number three.
Although social economic status appeared to play an important role in the location of commercial hazardous waste facilities, race still proved to be more significant.
What do you think of that? Clearly, poverty is a key factor there. As a matter of fact, where's the eraser? Do you mind if I erase a little section right here? You might call this the circle of death. This is from Barry Commoner of Common Cause. He points out that poverty and powerlessness in combination with or related to institutional racism kind of describes the dynamics of environmental racism. That poverty is a key factor. And it's interesting that in terms of environmental issues, the issue of class and race clearly begin to overlap. So that poverty becomes an especially poignant and crucial aspect of it. But nonetheless, according to the research that was done by the UCC, race still proved to be the more significant factor in the location of commercial hazardous waste facilities. Someone read number four.
3 out of every 5 Black and Hispanic Americans lived in communities with uncontrolled toxic waste sites.
What is an uncontrolled toxic waste site? Anybody got any illustrations of such? What might that be?
Where they're just dumping into the water. We had the keep on problem in the James River in Virginia. And I think it was the national news.
Tell us about it, so maybe not all of us heard about it.
Well, in Hopewell, the Allied Chemical was dumping keep on into the James River. And for some time it was discovered because, of course, I think the clams were and the oysters were affected first in the Chesapeake Bay. And, of course, they had been doing this for some time, and it was a mess. And keephole is something that you can't just clean up. I mean, it's going to be there a while. So just careless dumping. And evidently the management knew that this was a problem, but it was cheaper to dump it in the river than to haul it somewhere. I don't know if that's an example of what you're talking
about.
Sounds
like it to me. A lot of the issue is regulation, that is, unenforced regulations in terms of uncontrolled toxic waste sites. You have to underscore the sites. There's also, without a doubt, in many, many underdeveloped communities or inadequately developed communities, there would be things like inadequate waste, you know, disposal systems and so on.
There's also the problem with things like Love Canal, where the industry is long gone. They've left their waste behind, and they've been forgotten about, and the population now has moved out and occupied those sites, and they're kind of a lurking bomb.
Yeah. Yes. And often, sites like that, homes go for really good prices. And if you're not aware of the history, as many low-income people are not, you go where you can afford to go. And many times, that's in places that have been built over that formerly were waste dumps or industrial sites.
That's a converse example, also in Virginia, with it close to Front Royal, where they had a large rayon fiber plant that they kept open because it supplied the only fiber that they needed for the space shuttle. So there was a lot of defense money poured into it, trying to keep the thing afloat, and it was going under faster and faster. And finally, it closed. They just couldn't, the place just rotting under their feet. And the EPA moved in real quick and set up, and they're super fun, and they're really cleaning the place up, and they're doing all sorts of work. And it's not a minority neighborhood. It's not, you know, it's been there for 40 years, but I was astounded to see how fast they moved in to do the cleanup. There have been complaints from the neighborhood for years. Damage done, but all of a sudden, you know, they're on the site going after it. So there was concern and concerted effort given where it wasn't just rotting away, festering a long time.
Yes, and
what was the race of the people around
there? Well, very white. So I mean, that's what I'm saying, the converse there. There is attention given.
So in a way, it illustrates, doesn't it, or documents.
But it's because it's white.
Right.
Right.
and that's Keystone. The problem is that us white folks wanted more oysters, and that's what sent them into orbit for that. When it attacked the Chesapeake Bay, our precious white bay.
Someone read the next one. Number five.
Blacks were heavily overrepresented in the populations of metropolitan areas with the largest number of uncontrolled toxic waste sites. Memphis, St. Louis, Houston, Cleveland, Chicago, and Atlanta.
Anybody here live in any of those cities now?
I live 130 miles south of Chicago.
Okay, and George lives in Chicago. Does that seem to ring true with you, in your experience?
Yeah.
Certainly those are cities that are known to have large, very large African American communities. Someone read number six.
Approximately half of all Asian Pacific Islanders and American Indians live in communities with uncontrolled toxic waste sites. On the Indian reservations in the Southwest, houses were built with uranium piling. They mixed it with the concrete and built the houses, and they knew what they were doing.
Any other illustrations or comments on that one? Yes, George.
Up in northern Minnesota, in 5 years we were there, there were plans to build a slight high-level nuclear waste dump, low-level nuclear waste dump, an incinerator for toxic waste, an incinerator to recycle tires, and to turn a lot of the national forest next to the reservation to the Tang train ground. So this is all approved 5 years.
Yes. Very interesting example related to that is one Nadine already mentioned, that one of the small reservations in Minnesota is the Nevelkanten Dakota Reservation at Prairie Island, which is on the St. Croix River. And our large public facility, public utility company called Northern States Power intends to put a high-level nuclear waste site right next to the reservation. Now, there's a lot of interesting things in that connection when you look at it. One, NSP generally has a super reputation as a corporate citizen. And recently, a study in major corporations in Minnesota revealed that they have the best record of diversifying their workforce and of dealing with a diversifying workforce. Where the environmental racism comes in is that they never felt that it was necessary to deal directly with that community in deciding where to put the nuclear waste dump. What they did is they did their own research and figured that they had figured out a way to make the high-level waste dump safe and to safeguard the health of all the people in the area. So from their perspective, they knew it was safe. And so therefore, it wasn't necessary to involve the Indian people in the decision to locate the waste dump there. And they will be the first to say this is not environmental racism because that is not unsafe. Now, there are people who want to argue about nuclear energy who will debate with them as to whether or not it's safe. But that's beside the point. The point is that they did not honor the tribal sovereignty of those people or the integrity of that community by consulting them or involving them in the decision-making process. They just decided this is most convenient for us, so we're going to locate it right here, right beside that small reservation. There's a heated debate right now in Minnesota that's in the courts. Now, one other factor, the Prairie Island community now has a large casino, which is raking in money hand over fist. So they can afford to hire high-powered lawyers to defend their case in the courts. And interestingly enough, for the first time, NSP wants to sit down and talk with these folks and see if we can't figure out a way to keep this out of the courts. But they never once figured they ought to deal directly with that community when they first put the nuclear power plant there or when they began planning where to store the wastes. That's environmental racism. Yes.
They probably also knew that they would meet a lot of resistance if they had done it downriver.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Right. Yes.
A couple of things come to mind from overseas. Two examples in the Middle East, not far from where we live. During some of the fighting in Lebanon, some of the different militias, the Druze or the Maronite militias in the parts of Beirut and Lebanon that they controlled, they agreed to take hazardous waste from Europe, some of which was on ships sailing around looking for a place to dump for years. They agreed to take it and dumped it in the Mediterranean, in the little part of the coastline they controlled, for money with which to buy arms. So you get a different dimension to it, which where the racism is part of it, I think, but it's more of the situation of lawlessness, no regulations, and people in power taking advantage of this situation to zap whoever happened to be swimming or living or eating nearby. One other similar thing is there's a fair few countries in West Africa, around Sierra Leone, who have accepted, there's some tin pot dictators there who can get a little foreign exchange, by agreeing on their own bat, as leaders of these countries, to take European hazardous waste and leave it in the jungle in Central African Republic or leave it somewhere there. They get hard currency for it, the people don't have a thing to say about it. So you have a phenomenon of someone from the other race being party to the exploitation in a pretty typical pattern.
Yes, one of the scenarios of the business of powerlessness and power is that those who are powerless really get conscripted into maintaining the power dynamic through, you know, buying them off. My gosh, you know, it doesn't take too many hundred thousands of dollars or millions of dollars, and folks who are in the position of powerlessness will throw in their destiny with the powerful. Other comments? Yes.
Well, it's not just Europe and Africa. The United States does the same thing in the Central American countries. And the interesting thing is that there are environmental groups that have formed in the different countries of Central America. And these groups are helping to educate the people in the country so that the leadership of the countries cannot accept barges coming to Belize, for example, or dumping of different kinds of toxic waste in the countries of Central America. But there's a very special kind of problem, which is related to pesticides. And pesticides that are not approved in this country are dumped on third world countries. They're sold, just like you all probably worked on, the issue of infant formulas, but the same issue is involved in the use of pesticides. What's not approved here is dumped on third world countries. But the interesting thing, it does come back.
Yes,
mm-hmm. It does come back. And there was a book written called Circle of Poison, and that explains how it comes back to rest.
When DDT is used in Central America, 7 days, it's over the Great Lakes and rain. Which is interesting. Yeah, let me call your attention to two articles we put on the wall. I know everybody won't have time to read them, but it picks up on exactly the thing, Maria, that you were saying. The whole business of exporting death, and most dramatically pesticides. I apologize for not having this photocopy to share with you, but this is a little graphic, which in 1990 shows 3 months' worth of pesticide exports by the U.S. and shows where they go. And the darker colored nations are where most of the exports go. And interestingly enough, they're in the third world, and most of them are nations of color. They're populated by people of color. And we have some other articles too, but draw your attention particularly to these. One from the Star Tribune in Minneapolis and one from the Pioneer Press. Our time is coming to a close, and so Nadine is going to just do a quick summation for us. But again, thank you for being part of this session. But unless you have to, don't leave yet. There's still a couple of things we want to share with you.
We want to once again illuminate the issue of racism and how it's in its form. But we have to start somewhere. And what I mean by that is, picking up again on last night, we felt we had to to share with you, and again to bring about the awareness, the hidden and more subtle things that are going on. And as one of our people pointed out last night, she said all these things seem so normal that we didn't know that these were the actions of racism and prejudicial attitudes. But that's a fact. That's a given. That is not head beating by any means. That is what we're faced with in our society. So we have a challenge to own up to that and then think about how it is to change. Because we live in a racist society. We are not exempt from that at all. And we have a choice to be part of the problem or part of the solution. And as we discover, we have quite a bit of problem. And to begin to think about the challenge of the future, then we have a choice of being part of the solution. But I want to share something with you, and also this is another resource book, and I'm going to read just a brief phrase from Two Nations by Andrew Hacker. It's called Two Nations, Black and White, Separate, Hostile, and Unequal. A century and a quarter after slavery, white America continues to ask of its black citizens an extra patience and perseverance that whites have never required of themselves. So the question of white Americans is essentially moral. Is it right to impose on members of an entire race a lesser start in life and then to expect from them a degree of resolution that has never been demanded from your own race?